This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Today's episode is sponsored by Donors Trust, the principled, tax-friendly way to simplify your charitable giving. More on them in a bit. My guest is Shane Moss, a comedian who tours the country discussing his psychedelic experiences in really fantastic, mesmerizing, immersive multimedia shows with titles like DMT, A Love Story, and A Better Trip. If you're in the New York area, he'll be appearing at the Psychedelic Assembly in Midtown Manhattan, October 27 to 31st, as part of a really kind of great spookadelic haunted house. So check that out. I caught up with Shane at the Psychedelic Science 2023 conference, which was held in Denver this June, where he participated in a comedy roast of the psychedelic scene. Shane also hosts a science podcast called Here We Are, and we talk a little bit about that. He also shared his thoughts with Reason about the mainstreaming of psychedelic drugs, the surprising pace of legalization, and the role that Joe Rogan and other public figures play in normalizing psychedelics and promoting cognitive liberty. Here is the Reason interview with Shane Moss.
Yeah, we're in a psychedelic renaissance, a lot of people call it. It's certainly a psychedelic moment. Like, what does the psychedelic renaissance mean to you?
I don't know what the psychedelic renaissance means to me. I can tell you that as someone who was born in 1980 and experienced much of the Reagan era, just say no to drugs, and early 90s PSAs and the frying egg and this is your brain on drugs type stuff, I never pictured a world where marijuana would be anywhere close to legal, and it's mind-blowing to me that mushrooms are being decriminalized everywhere. I started a science podcast, Here We Are, 8 years ago, and at that time, the number of organizations even attempting to jump through all of the regulatory hoops to just test psychedelics in any way at all, there was just MAPS, which was much smaller even just 8 years ago, doing it in a couple other small organizations, and now there's all sorts of Johns Hopkins and Stanford and a zillion universities are getting into
it. What do you think changed? Like, why now? Why are psychedelics suddenly everywhere?
That is a very good question. Why now? I have no idea. I don't know what changed. I don't know if this is just what progress looks like and it's inevitable. I don't know that that's the case. I have no idea. I didn't see this coming. I think that maybe just the war on drugs was such horrible policy in the first place that it was never going to last.
So it's kind of like communism, right? Eventually it runs out of something.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't know. I don't know enough about public policy to speculate on.
One of the things, I mean, you know, you're kind of a psychedelic comedian, right?
Or
I mean, you talk a lot about that. You have a show which is built around your psychedelic experiences. Mm-hmm. What do you like about psychedelics?
Psychedelics just changed my life. I did them just as kind of a goof when I was a teenager, just to be a rebel or whatever, and had smoked weed and laughed a bunch and thought it was great. But psychedelics were something more meaningful for me. I always had pretty serious depression issues from the age of 10 years old, I would say. And they were something that really helped with that.
When we say they, what kinds of psychedelics are you talking about?
Mushrooms were my all-time favorite, my go-to for a very, very long time. And then I think if it weren't for DMT, I probably wouldn't have a science podcast. I was always interested in how the mind worked. And then when I first smoked DMT, I became absolutely obsessed with trying to figure out what the heck was that.
Can you describe the experience that you had that you're like, I got to figure out what's going on here?
Well, I was raised in a strict religious household. I didn't fit into that. I was always an atheist, especially in my younger years. I was a very angry, bitter atheist. I felt very bitter about my strict upbringing. And
what kind of religion was it?
Catholic. Okay. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
So you have the Holy Sacrament. I mean, you have LSD.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that to have a DMT experience that seems like you're talking with entities or in some other world, or is this an afterlife, or how do you explain, is this some other dimension? That is the subjective feeling of a lot of experiences. It just made me go, well, how could I perceive something like that? Because I usually by the end of it, I'd be like, I actually don't think I was in some other dimension. I think it was in my brain. So then the question is, how would a brain make a perception that is so different than this conscious experience? And it just got me really digging into how the subconscious mind works and neuroscience. And it was incredibly impactful for me. Over and over again, psychedelics have had, I started doing ketamine years ago, and other than falling on ketamine and scraping my face, it's been nothing but really interesting.
Is falling and scraping your face on ketamine the new thinking you can fly on LSD?
I guess this looks much worse than it is. Right. Yeah. I'm a bit of a psychonaut of sorts. I don't suppose to do like the most reasonable ways of doing psychedelics. And so, like, if anyone watches my documentary Psychonautics or anything, they'll see it. I think I have kind of a balanced take on psychedelics. I have a lot of inherent disclaimers just in my own. You can look at this face and go like, well, maybe I should pause before doing ketamine outside of a nightclub so I don't fall over.
You know, psychedelics have become big enough where, I mean, you participated in a roast of the psychedelic community. What are the parts of the psychedelic community that you like the most? And then we'll get to what you find objectionable about, but like what's great about not just the drugs, but the community that's building up around it.
Yeah, I've always liked the community. I did psychedelics just alone pretty much for a very long time until I started experimenting with doing a psychedelic show. And I think 2015 was when I first started doing a few of those. And I'd never been to Burning Man. I had never been to any psychedelic festivals. And so once I started meeting the type of people that would come out to a psychedelic comedy show, one, it wasn't the cliche burnout, dreadlocked, their only hygiene is sound bath type. these ideas of, Cheech and Chong or whatever, this ridiculous idea of what drugs are like. It was never like that. Sure, I'd sometimes have one table of burnouts, a bunch of cliches, but you would just meet the most interesting, intelligent people. I'd been doing science shows for years, and it can be tough sledding sometimes getting people to have the attention span to listen to jokes about biology or whatever. And when I remember the very first time that I did a show about psychedelics, the engagement was overwhelming. And afterwards, there was a line of people. I've been a successful comedian since 2004, and I've been on late night and everything else. And you'll go and do shows and just absolutely blow the roof off this place. And afterwards, a lot of times people will be like, hey, nice show, and leave. You do a psychedelic comedy show, and there's a line of people that has a million questions, and they're meeting each other in line and connecting. And the psychedelic community is just so inquisitive and so open. And I would say my criticism is sometimes maybe a little too open-minded and a little.
What do you mean by that?
Maybe a little. I would like to see a little more critical thinking in some of the aspects of.
Yeah, what are the parts of the psychedelic community or, kind of known psychedelic users that you find objectionable or annoying?
Sure. Well, I mean, I can tell you as someone that, I did 111 city psychedelic comedy tour, ended in 2017. It was just the greatest tour of my life. I loved meeting people every show. I loved starting going to festivals and everything else. And then COVID happened. And as someone who interviews virologists mm-hmm. and epidemiologists and things like that, the number of just insane, not just conspiracies, but absolute like anger and harassment that just anyone doing any kind of science, it was like a like kill the messenger. Granted, this is the internet mm-hmm. and you're seeing the worst of worst cases, but it certainly opened my eyes to I think some of the problematic errors in thinking within the community, some of the magical thinking, a lot of the grifting in the space. I mean, I think that there's a lot of pretty dubious like supplements and things like that being peddled, and treatments and cure all, and telling people you can like cure their cancer with coffee enemas and stuff like that, that seem like adjacent
more of like
within
a
the space
tea thing or kombucha.
You definitely need tea in your butt to cure cancer, not coffee.
What do you think? And do you want to talk about Joe Rogan or not?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, there are a lot of, or an increasing number of very public people who talk about their psychedelic use. Joe Rogan is one. Mm-hmm. Is he a purveyor of misinformation or uncritical thinking?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been on Joe Rogan's show. I find him to be, you know, a good interviewer, a nice guy. And, you know, he's just, Alex Jones is one of his best friends. It's just his shtick. He's been into, you know, oh, did the aliens make the pyramids? He had a show where he would like go and talk to Bigfoot hunters, and you know, I guess it's a little discouraging. Someone who likes science, when I watch like the Animal Planet and Finding Bigfoot is the most popular show, or I try to watch the History Channel to learn something, and Ancient Aliens is the most popular show on there. And it is what it is, but I think that it's created a kind of you know, any show, if you're going to like get on late night, each late night person or Comedy Central or Netflix is looking for something different. And to get on Joe Rogan's show, a way to get on there is to have like some big controversial idea or something like that. I think that he ends up kind of being subjected to just a lot of grifters and just a lot of people that are telling him what he already wants to hear and dressing it up in some sciencey sounding thing that is.
Do you think the psychedelic community is more open to kind of bad thinking or conspiracist thinking or anti-science thinking, you know, than like the population at large? Or
The population at large, I don't know. I find the psychedelic community to be very intelligent, but I would say that, you know, because of the nature of it being such an underground thing, I think it's drawn people that are unconventional, that maybe don't like authority as much, and which is great. I mean, I think we should all absolutely be questioning science and authorities and laws and all of the time. I very much support that. I think that it's sometimes, like, as someone who can be too much of a contrarian themselves, sometimes it's like a race to see who can have like the most far out idea, because there's a lot of creative people in the space, and then also you want to like get attention for your ideas and advertise your ideas, and some of those like more far out ideas are sexier and more tantalizing than you know, reality for some people. I think reality is very interesting. Some people think reality is like very boring. And
what about, you know, so there's the, you know, there's the kind of psychedelic, you know, strangeness on the one side, or people buying any theory. Then there's also the like a whole subset of people who are like, I'm going to use these incredibly, you know, visionary, weird, whacked out drugs in order to become a better office worker. You know, you call them the optimizers. What's your beef with the optimizers?
This is the optimizers, the life hackers out there. I mean, I just find them a little funny and comical sometimes. I think some of the motivational stuff is probably just because my personal resistance and problems with self-care, I'm probably just projecting a little bit, like I don't want to hear that or whatever. But I think it's it seems like there's a lot of commonality where you are overly prescriptive within these influencers in like the self-help community. And it's very, if you give people like very, very odd and particular instructions, then one, that increases the placebo effect, but two, if it doesn't work for them, you're putting the ownership on the user, and you go, well, you right. just must not have done yeah. the protocol correctly. There's not a problem with my protocol or my advice that I'm giving you as the user.
You did step three when you should have been doing step two or something.
Exactly.
Like that,
yeah. You didn't cure your cancer with the coffee enema. You right. must not have done enough of them, or maybe you did too many of yeah. them, or you didn't do it for long enough, or you should have
used decaf tea instead.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we continue with the Reason interview with Shane Moss, let me tell you about today's sponsor, Donors Trust. You know, in a world where lawmakers continue to dig us deeper into debt and borrow more from foreign powers while spending like drunken sailors at home go on, we want to make a difference, right? We want our dollars to actually reach the people we think we're helping. Americans at home are increasingly penalized for free speech and free expression, especially on college campuses. Headlines abound post-COVID about government dollars that never even reached the people the money was supposed to help. You know, money set aside for schools never made it to independent schools. Money set aside for rent relief was slow to make its way to tenants, if it arrived at all. So do you want to make a real difference in the world instead of relying on ineffectual government programs? Maybe you want to push back against heavy-handed government regulations that encroach on civil liberties, especially after living through the corruption that became so apparent during the pandemic. If this sounds like you, consider opening a giving account with my friends at Donors Trust. Giving accounts with Donors Trust are simple, secure, and tax-advantaged. The Donors Trust team understands the conservative and libertarian philanthropic landscape, and they know which charities are clawing back our civil liberties. For more information on how Donors Trust can help you with your charitable giving, visit donorstrust.org/Nick, and you'll receive a free copy of their donor prospectus. That's donorstrust.org/Nick. DonorsTrust.org/Nick. Go to donorstrust.org/Nick right now to download your free Donors Trust prospectus. And now back to the Reason interview with Shane Moss.
What, you've done a bunch of different psychedelic themed shows, documentaries, you have a science show. What's the role of cultural production, for lack of a better term, in kind of making psychedelics normalized?
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, I started comedy in 2004. I was like a typical late night, like, short joke, absurdist comedian. And I've always been interested in psychedelics. So even back then, I would sprinkle in a few psychedelic jokes here and there. And I found that if I did a regular comedy club, I could do 5 minutes of psychedelic jokes and it would be funny. Usually they were like goofy ones, like I've ate too many mushrooms and saw this weird thing, you know? And if I talked about them much more than that, you would start getting funny looks, like, what's up with this guy? Why is he talking about drugs so much? And more, as this becomes just more of a part of the mainstream, I can tell you distinctly, my 111 city psychedelic comedy tour ended in May of 2017, and I had all of these deals potentially in the works and ran into all sorts of barriers with like Showtime and HBO not wanting to. They didn't have a problem talking about drugs. They had a problem talking about potential benefits and these talking about psychedelics as medicines. That was very taboo to them. They wouldn't touch it. And I think June 2017 is when Michael Pollan's book came out and was the first time there's a psychedelic book on the front of almost every bookstore right, in the country.
They made it, like, say, for NPR. I mean, like, he mainstreamed the discussion.
And so it was already, you know, making progress, for sure. I had seen that over 10 or 15 years. And there's, like, little things like that where there's a pop, and suddenly my mom has a Michael Pollan's book. And that's something I never
Have you ever tripped with your mom?
Oh, no. I can't imagine that ever. I would. I certainly would. I'd have a better shot with my dad, maybe, but I don't think that, you know, it makes me sad. It's something that I think about sometimes when, you know, I can be a reckless user of psychedelics sometimes, but I have a lot of beautiful, meaningful experiences that I learn a lot from. And sometimes I think about people like, you know, I lost my grandma recently, that she never got to have an experience like that in her entire life, that my parents will probably never get to have an experience like that, that I won't get to have an experience with them because of all of the past propaganda and war on drugs and just how much of an impact that that had on culture. I mean, Nixon and a lot of the first criminalizing of drugs did start. It's like it was very conspiratorial and it was very like Machiavellian and everything else. But once it took effect, it didn't take any of that. It didn't. It was just a natural emergent. Like there, it didn't. It no longer required people to like be plotting against, you know, civil rights groups or whatever else. It just enough people just bought into the propaganda that. Even people that were open-minded about it, it was never going to be on their radar to get rid of these laws. And so just so recently with, you know, Michael Pollan's books and then opening the doors for others, for all of my criticisms of people like Aaron Rodgers or someone that might be peddling a bunch of anti-science nonsense, it's still to have some like huge NFL Hall of Famer, you know, praising psychedelics. You know, there's pros and cons to it. And I don't expect, you know, NFL football players to like, you know, be the most scientifically informed. And nor do I expect multi-millionaires to be able to check their ego all the time. So,
you know, what do you think the benefits would be to society where psychedelic use or psychedelics are just normalized?
That's a really interesting question because I'm not exactly one of those people that's like, if you just put LSD in the drinking water and everyone did LSD, like the world would be peace and love. And I've seen the negative effects of psychedelics. I've been to a psych ward twice myself. I know that psychedelics aren't perfect and the very things that can help some people's mental health can hurt others. And I think that ultimately, although I have mixed feelings about just like making everything legal, the war on drugs is a horrible failure. I mean, I don't know what else there is to do but just get rid of the absurd laws around them. And you know, it will make me nervous when people are doing psychedelics more and more willy-nilly because there's unexpected things. Like, you know, marijuana changed my life. I no longer like this stuff, but absolutely just, I had such a beautiful few year run with marijuana. I loved it. I never saw marijuana being legalized. I was thrilled, even though it's no longer my cup of tea, thrilled to see it go so legal and get so popular and have my grandma, I think, did CBD before. Like, my God, I never saw that coming. And then, you know, sometimes you go, oh, did people forget that also marijuana can make you like paranoid and stuff as well? And you know, I wonder if, you know, would Joe Rogan be as into peddling conspiracies and anti-vax propaganda if he didn't smoke weed all day and that was like his whole big shtick? I don't know. You know,
what's it like, or how do you feel about this? This conference seems to be part of the process where a psychedelic culture, which is underground or a subculture or a counterculture, is like moving above ground. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as somebody who's been in this space for a while, are you like, I liked LSD's early work, you know, before everybody knew about it. Or, I mean, how, what's it like to be part of a world, you know, a community, a movement that is moving from underground to above ground?
I've been a big supporter of MAPS for years. I've actually defended a lot of like criticism. You know, a lot of people are worried they've gone too corporate, and so I worry about that as well. I worry about any organization when they like get really big or whatever else. I just love finding ways to legitimize the scientific process. If I were king, or if I were just, you know, a politician with a little bit of influence, say, I think that one very reasonable step would just to not make psychedelics a Schedule One, just maybe make them a Schedule Two.
Which means Schedule One means it has no accepted medical use and a high
and it's highly
potential
addictive.
For addiction.
And the only thing that that making something a Schedule One does effectively is it doesn't deter use in any way, because no one's like, what schedule is this drug that I'm going to put in my mouth? Most people are just unfamiliar.
Right.
And then it also doesn't necessarily influence the laws. So there's like no deterrent property if we're like, hey, don't do this or you'll go to jail. Well, you'll get in more trouble for a Schedule Two cocaine than you will a Schedule One marijuana. That's legal in most places. So the only thing that having it being a Schedule One really does is it makes it so incredibly difficult for scientists to just run basic studies like you'd test and anything else. I mean, we've made mini black holes and particle accelerators. They used to think that if you did that, the universe would implode. And it turns out it doesn't. But you can test whether or not the universe will implode easier than you can test LSD on rats. Right. And I think that's going to create more harm if we can't investigate these things. So I'm not about being the cool kid hipster about psychedelics. I'm thrilled to see more and more scientific organizations getting to be a part of it. I have more pause about some of the influencer community out there and some of the wellness community that is, I think a lot of it comes from a good place, but I've seen some stuff that I'm like, oof.
What do you mean?
You know, my mom growing up was always falling for every, you know, like door-to-door salesman pyramid scheme type stuff. So I was just so used to being exposed to these multi-level pyramid scheme things and, you know, having Tupperware parties and getting, you know, this and that vitamin is going to do this, and you got to get magnets in your shoes. And as my whole life, I've seen, you know, why people like that stuff and you know, take 40 different vitamins that don't do anything rather than getting actual exercise. And so there's a lot of things out there being sold to people that I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I think that life is about finding the placebo that works for you ultimately. So, you know, I would say just make your own snake oil. It's gonna be more effective if you go out there and you catch the snake yourself and research how to oil it. It's gonna increase the placebo effect, and your subconscious is gonna go, well, I wouldn't have chased around a snake and oiled it for nothing. You know, it's gonna be more likely to work. And so there's just, I'd say that there's a fair amount of snake oil out there that I think just overlaps with alternative thinking and more creative communities. And I think it's like, you know, we all kind of want to pretend we have magic powers or are going to be immortal or whatever. And I think that there's opportunities for people to take advantage of people's hope.
If you project, you know, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years into the future where, you know, things have been psychedelicized, you know, what's that world look like?
I have a lot of good questions. What does a world look like 40 years from now where potentially psychedelics are continue to track and become like really normalized? I think that for people to have more options, even just to like escape reality or responsibility or whatever, even in the like more reckless use of things than just drinking their face off every day. I think that I think that there is a correlation between younger people aren't drinking as much. And I think part of that has to do with marijuana and some of these other substances becoming more normalized, that there is like lots more alternatives for people. So I think even the lowest bar of that, of just like less drunk driving, less alcoholism. And I think that, I think that there will be a lot of excitement for a while, and hopefully 40 years from now, this will just be commonplace. We'll be bored with these. There'll be no use for a psychedelic comedy show, because who cares? It's like, it's like, you know, marijuana based comedy is almost like kind of old and tacky by now. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's a sign of progress. I hope that 5 years from now, it'd be the hokiest, dumbest thing for me to still be doing a psychedelic show. I think that might be a little soon for it, but I'm hopeful that will be the case. I have other stuff I'd like to talk about.
What's your favorite psychedelic?
My favorite psychedelic? Oh my gosh, mushrooms are my all-time favorite. Absolute, my go-to for depression and for creativity. If I'm putting together a new act or something like that, I have such wonderful epiphanies on psychedelics. I have such funny insights and meaningful takeaways. Ketamine is the only psychedelic that I do like very willy-nilly, because typically consequence-free, but it doesn't require the same like building up of, so I get to have like a very fun, interesting experience without having to worry as much about the integration and like hyping myself up and nausea. And DMT is the most interesting thing I've ever done in my life. I've had 100 DMT breakthroughs, and it never got more boring. It only got weirder. I stopped because it kept getting too interesting. And I did 5-MeO DMT recently, and it was like, that had to have been the most profound psychedelic experience that I've ever had. MDMA, if I'm in a relationship, and maybe we're talking through relationship problems in a loving and meaningful way. So context is very important. If I only get one for the rest of my life, it's mushrooms, but I'm going to be so sad to say goodbye to those others.
Shane Moss, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple or Google or Spotify or SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up, subscribe, don't miss a single episode. Leave a review, rate and review us. Let me know what I'm doing well, what you think I should change. Give me ideas for guests. But go there, or make it easy on yourself and just go to reason.com/podcast and sign up there. While you're at reason.com/podcast, you can also check out our other series, The Reason Roundtable, the Soho Forum Debates, and a great 6-part limited series called Why We Can't Have Nice Things, which actually shows how trade policy and the lack of free trade screws up all kinds of things in our lives, from baby formula pricing and shortages to women's underwear to frozen chicken. Why We Can't Have Nice Things is a great, tight 6-part series that will make your blood boil. But that and all the other shows are at reason.com/podcast. Go there, subscribe, sign up, let us know how we're doing, and I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.